Hurry into Menards right now and save big money. Miracle-Gro raised bed soil helps you grow bigger, more bountiful plants. It provides the right foundation your plants need to thrive with a 100% organic formula that requires no mixing. Add Miracle-Gro raised bed soil to help your plants grow with organic nutrients you can count on. Visit our garden center or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Welcome back to Pass Gas, everybody. My name is Nolan. Bart's across from me, and this week we're talking about Gambala, a company that by the end of this episode, I'm sure you will agree, is really underrated, really underappreciated, created some amazing cars, and unfortunately had a pretty sad ending. So this is a cool story, a sad story, with some really badass cars along the way. Sit back, relax, or pay attention to driving if that's what you're doing right now. I don't know. And enjoy the story of Gambala. The year is 2020. It's early morning on the streets of Manhattan when suddenly a sports car careens out of control, sideswipes several parked cars, and crashes to a halt. The driver revs the $1 million plus machine and peels out, leaving an expensive path of destruction before his engine seizes up and he is taken into custody. Video of the debacle spread like wildfire across the internet, and it doesn't take long for automotive enthusiasts to realize that this isn't just a normal Porsche Carrera GT, which is a rare sighting in itself. In fact, the car is arguably one of the rarest on the planet, the Porsche Gambala Mirage GT, a $780,000 masterpiece of engineering. But despite the waves it made, somehow the carnage of this event fits in perfectly with the Gambala timeline. Just one more controversial blip for a company who redefined what customization and excess can mean in a road car. So, how did a small tuning workshop in Germany become a globally recognized brand? How has Gambala continued its legacy of stunning aftermarket design today? And what led to the mysterious disappearance of their founder? Buckle up for a ride into a world of opulent luxury, monumental success, and salacious tragedy. Today on Pass Gas, it's Gambala. Hello and welcome back to the show, everybody. It feels like it's been a long time, but for us, temporally, it has been. But for the listener, it has not.
Yeah.
My name is Nolan Sykes. Joining me across the desk, very wobbly desk, Bart Bidlingmeyer.
Hi, good to be here. Dude, thanks for having me.
It's been over
a month. So Joe and I were doing a few without you.
That's right.
Because you were driving across the country.
Yeah. And I still have to.
You have more to come.
I think by the time the listener hears this, we will have been done with the whole project, I think. But yeah, it's been like a month since I've seen you.
I think it's been more than that because it's been like 3 weeks since I shot and you hadn't been here for a few weeks before that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah. I was on jury. I'm good. I was on jury. Those 3 weeks, I was on jury duty.
Oh, can you discuss the case?
Yeah, it's over. I can say anything I want about it.
Yeah.
But it, you know, you get your summons and you're like, ah, jury duty. And then you go in and you'll be like, all right, usually it's a big room and half of you get dismissed.
Yeah,
I was like juror 76, so I was like, down the line, I'm not going to.
Better than juror number two, huh?
Well, I'll tell you what, jury selection took a long time.
Yeah.
And like you get in there, you sit down, and you're like, all right, like what, you know, murder one.
Oh.
Yeah, murder
and
one
then
in
your
Compton.
Ears, you perk up a little bit.
Well, I'm kind of like, you know, we're gonna be here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then I was, after all was said and done, I was alternate three.
Oh, so you're just like.
And then alternate two had to take a seat. Mm-hmm. I was there for the whole thing.
So you were an alternate. You had to sit in and listen to all.
I don't
the details.
Get to deliberate. I don't. During deliberation, the alternates can't even talk to each other about the case.
Wow.
So the whole thing went by, and I got to tell you. I think 12 people got it wrong.
Really?
Yeah. There was so much evidence that didn't make sense that I'll talk to you later about. Dude, I'm sorry, everybody. This is going to be my next podcast.
I was going to say it's a great premise for a podcast. I don't know how much of that we'll use in this episode. It is pertinent because the story of Gambala also has a heavy
mm-hmm.
crime element to it that we'll get to. So here we go. Let's talk Gambala. Uwe Gambala was born in 1955 near Stuttgart, Germany. Coincidentally, Stuttgart is also the birthplace of the Porsche Automotive Group, which seems fitting for how Uwe and the legendary car manufacturer were destined for a future together. Of course, we've talked about Porsche a lot on mm-hmm. the show recently.
Roof.
Porsche. And Roof. Mm-hmm. Yes. Details about Uwe's childhood remain sparse, but in one of his rare interviews later in life, Uwe said that his early passion was motorcycles. While still in school during the 1970s, he spent weekends racing bikes, but his interests soon shifted to four-wheeled machines fueled by a fascination with the Porsche 911.
The I started in motorcycles is almost a trope now, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's been so many, like, pioneers of tuning, motorsports, yeah. everything. I started, even, like, all of the drivers, and which is because when you're a kid, you aren't driving a car, yeah. you're riding bikes. Yeah. Like, so many drivers come from two-wheeled motorsport.
And, yeah. Anyways, it's Uwe purchased his first 911 when he was in college. Man, that must be nice. And found pleasure in reworking his car's interior. Man, I wanted so badly just to buy an NB Miata, and it's like yeah. $3,000 for
one of those at the time. You know what's so funny, though, is like, is to that point, if you're in college listening to this and you're thinking of getting a car, do it now.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah, when he got his Porsche, it's like a little better than the Beetle.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean?
Right, like, yeah. He decided to turn his passion into a profession and started a small tuning shop in 1979. Headquartered in Leonberg, a small town outside of Stuttgart, Uwe and a small group of craftsmen he assembled delivered never-before-seen luxury upgrades to BMWs and Porsches, focusing solely on interiors at first.
To the point of, like, how do you become a tuning shop? I think that's pretty cool that it's like, we're going to focus on making your car more luxurious for you.
Yeah.
And it's kind of what, like, Maybach will do everything,
mm-hmm.
but the interior is an important, yeah. you know, like, let's
it's
guss it up a bit.
Overlooked, I think, aspect of car customization.
Yeah.
My
Absolutely.
Wife has an old Lexus sedan. Mm-hmm. She loves, like, leopard print and cheetah stuff, like, that kind of, like,
yeah.
extravagant,
tacky kind of stuff. How old is the car?
2004.
Okay.
And she wants, like, leopard print foot mats and, like, dash cover
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's something I would never, ever want, but
right.
It
right.
would be kind of cool in this instance.
It's to the point, like, there's companies, I think Zancan is the name of one of them. But
Zancan.
They do, it's like, great, we have all of the specs for these cars' mm-hmm. seats. Tell us what you want, and we'll
yeah.
make you those seats. And it's not even, like, the seat cover crap.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, nah, we'll rip the old shit off and put on a legit.
I love that.
Anyways.
Yeah.
So
I should look into that.
Yeah, yeah. For her birthday. When's her birthday?
Next April.
Leopard print, baby.
Leopard print. That would be kind of sick. Actually.
You know what you can do? Tell her you got into an accident.
Yeah, okay.
Ask him how much. Tell her you got an accident.
Hmm.
We'll do. You can call it. Well, no, we can do a video for Donut. And we'll call it underhauling.
Underhauling.
And then deliver the car with all leopard inside.
Hell yeah!
And then she'd be like, "I was joking."
You think I'm into that? Okay, so as demand for his services began to grow, Uwe saw greater potential. He decided to go beyond tailoring interiors and begin creating complete body and performance overhauls. Overhauls. And officially founded Gambala in 1981. Hell yeah, here we go. In the late 70s, Porsche engineers realized that the round headlights on their 935 race car were bad for aerodynamics. So they designed the now iconic slant nose 935, which immediately reduced wind drag and resulted in wins at Le Mans and other elite European races. Gambala loved the slant nose 935 so much that he decided to adapt it to the 930 Turbo road car. But this was just the beginning. Uwe would go on to add gorgeous custom fenders, spoiler options, and unique paint colors, which resulted in singular creations that began to gain attention around Stuttgart.
Porsche has so many people who fall in love with it. I think, I'm trying to think of another company who has as many,
I see
like an aftermarket kind of tuner body
yeah.
company that is completely made around that car.
Hmm.
Because people are like, I love this so much, I'm going to put it on other things.
Yes.
Maybe the Dodge Magnum.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. But I did see a Dodge Mattingly with a Chrysler 500 front, and I was like, that's good.
I wish they made a Chrysler wagon. Yeah, that's a good question.
But there's like Corvettes, right, and there's, you know, and there's Chevy shops, and they're... Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's the same as like this instance of, oh, you did this new design thing. I'm going to take your new design thing and put it on these other cars that are also kind of like your cars. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you. Despite the body kits, the interiors Gambala produced were just as jaw-dropping. They pioneered technology such as LED instrument panels and remote control audio systems embedded in the steering wheel while customizing upholstery with the finest fabrics available. So they were very far ahead of the curve. This is still the early 80s. And that's pretty cool.
I'd like a nice houndstooth.
Oh, yeah. I feel, yeah. Yeah, me too. Some automotive purists scoffed at the idea of an aftermarket tuner who worked more like an artist than a mechanic, but only a few years into the 80s, there was no denying that Gambala had become a symbol of status and cutting-edge automotive technology. And here's some clarification. While other tuners in Germany, like Roof and Alpina, received manufacturer status and were able to release cars with their own VIN numbers, Gambala never achieved this status. Gambala cars still have the original Porsche VIN, but Gambala includes paperwork that details their modifications. Word of Gambala's 911 creation spread quickly, and it wasn't long before royal families, oil tycoons, celebrities, and other uber-wealthy car collectors from around the world began calling in requests for Uwe's one-of-a-kind machines. However, despite the demand, Uwe decided to venture into the great unknown by releasing his most iconic Porsche build yet. In 1984, Gambala created its first and easily one of its most recognizable models, the Avalanche. Mm. Oh, that's an interesting little guy.
Yeah, it's like a Ferrari Porsche.
Yes, it's got the Testarossa side strakes, for sure. Up until this point, Gambala focused mainly on aesthetics, like interior design and aero kits. This time would be different, however. The beating heart of the Avalanche was a heavily modified turbo flat six engine, which generated up to 400 horsepower, which was a stunning number for the 1980s. I don't care if your mom's
still
Explorer.
A pretty sick number, especially in a Porsche.
It's the perfect horsepower for a car of a certain size.
Yeah.
400's all you need, really. With a top speed of over 180 and the ability to go 0 to 60 in less than 5 seconds, the Avalanche was blazing fast. We'd probably go faster today with modern tires, too. Mm. We got to keep that in mind when discussing vintage 0 to 60 times. Tires was a big part of that.
Because I went to the car meet at Helms Bakery, and there was a, you know, early 80s Porsche with original tires.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, ugh. Yeah. But and Matt Farah was there. He's like, hold on, man. I'm just going to go over and tell this guy's about vintage tires. Like, don't use them.
Yeah.
You should not have driven that here.
That is anyways. Scary. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one, at the very least, you're going to inconvenience yourself.
They're 40 years old.
Yeah. Or you're going to spin out and kill yourself and destroy your car. The Avalanche was blazing fast, but thanks to upgraded suspension and braking, handling was also on par with or exceeded many of its contemporaries. And that's saying something. All of Gambala's competitors were tuning houses that had been around for decades and or OEMs. They're punching above their weight class here. Also, the 911, like, great. I mean, I think a reason a lot of these tuning companies were gravitated towards them is, like, it was a really great foundation anyway. Like, you didn't have to buy the super top-of-the-line
one. To say it's a great platform is an understatement.
Yeah, but we covered that in our Porsche series, where it's just, like, the engineering was top-notch, and just the design lent itself to really great handling in the first place. It didn't need to have the top-of-the-line suspension. It was just, like, the way they put the car together meant it was going to be great regardless.
Irregardless.
Despite its audacious horsepower, the first thing people noticed about the Avalanche was its jaw-dropping exterior design. The 935-inspired slant nose, integrated front and rear bumpers, pop-up headlights, flared wheel arches, and a massive spoiler added both eye-catching style and world-class function. And as Bart mentioned, it had the Testarossa side intakes. Gambala also made sure the paint on the Avalanche stood out, often finishing models with bold metallic colors paired with low-profile tires and custom wheels.
The fact that you're doing this to a Porsche and it comes out that, like, it really does look good.
It's sick.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's, it, I think that shouldn't be understated how difficult to make it look cohesive, evoking a Porsche, yeah, looking like its own car. And also, it is so 1984.
It's very,
you know what I mean? Like, it is just, yeah.
I was going to say, it definitely evokes Porsche, but also, like, I could see someone looking at this and absolutely hating it.
Yep.
Because it's Porsche enough, but it's also its own thing.
What did you do?
Yeah.
But I look at it and I'm like, that.
The spoiler so on it
and
is.
Look at it. Yeah.
Massive,
yes,
spoiler.
Yes. Bizarre.
It's so cool, but it is like the Porsche whale tail, but just take it turned up like 15 notches. Also, yeah, like, what are these little things on the rear windows? What are these elements?
Yeah, well, you
I don't
want
know
the air to go into, yeah, the, yeah.
That's, it's cool.
Just, it, yeah.
It's different.
It evokes a stingray, it's swimming through the water.
Ooh, manta ray.
Yeah, with the curl and the.
Yeah, thing, dude. Okay. Bringing some nature into it. I like it. Yeah, it's crazy. This thing's crazy. Inside the Avalanche.
Did you ever see the Miami Vice where Don Johnson has to go undercover?
No. Is that like every other episode?
There was one. It's I don't want to say they jumped the shark, because how can you do that with Miami Vice? But he, like, maybe it was Tubbs who did it.
My
somebody,
Manta Ray Johnson.
Somebody drove through. They had to get arrested so that they could go undercover in prison.
Oh.
So the way they got arrested was he ran through a toll booth,
okay,
and just
nice
shattered it. I think he was in a red Ferrari, but this car is what would run through a toll booth and 1,000% shatter it if you were on cocaine,
yes,
in Miami,
yes,
and wanted to get arrested.
Absolutely.
That's this car.
100%, Bart. Yeah. That thing's so sick. That's a very cocaine car, for sure. For sure. You'd go to...
now Radwood, a cocaine car is just the Nissan Sentra.
You'd go to
whatever.
Radwood, there'd be that guy who dresses up in like the 80s business chic. Remember that guy?
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And well, there were two, but in Miami, you'd be wearing a pink shirt and a white blazer with the sleeves rolled up.
It's a good look.
Yeah,
it's a good look.
No socks, baby.
Inside the Avalanche, Gambala tailored true extravagance. He had high-grade wood, gold, suede, and leather-covered seats and dashboards paired nicely with CD players, which is big back then, mm-hmm, rear-view camera systems, and video screens. This is crazy. The cockpit feel of the Avalanche was a cross between a spaceship and a fighter jet, with digital gauges and custom switchware options spread across the cluster and center console. Gambala was so state-of-the-art, much of the tech inside the Avalanche wasn't offered in the highest trim levels of Porsche. Wow. It would be decades before such options would become available to the general public. Roughly 15 of these Avalanches were built, with each being essentially a one-off creation, specially built to order for their wealthy owners. Emphasis on wealthy, because whoever was buying an Avalanche, guys like Vanilla Ice, were paying 10 times what a 911
who
turbo...
lived in Miami.
Miami. I was going to say Jacksonville, but that's Fred Durst. It's from Jacksonville.
I don't know. I think he lived in Miami, because he was... A1A was the... You know, that goes up the East Coast.
Okay.
Beachfront Avenue.
They were paying 10 times what a 911 turbo typically cost at the time. Let me make sure Fred Durst was from Jacksonville.
Maybe it's just where he has his construction empire.
Maybe. He was born in Jacksonville. Okay, good. Phew. Got my new metal facts right. That's all that matters. The Avalanche launched Gambala into the luxury car stratosphere, but Uwe wasn't about to rest on his laurels. Gambala had made a clear statement with the Avalanche that they could deliver a brutally fast, aggressive-looking coupe with unparalleled luxury. But with their next model, Uwe wanted to cater to customers who favored premium style and an open-air driving experience. Enter the Gambala Cirrus, which premiered shortly after the Avalanche in 1985. Oh, this thing... I think I would probably, I'd take this. Here's your crashing through the.
God, he's obsessed with those. See, I don't think, I don't think he nailed.
You don't think so?
I understand.
It's more understated.
It is a continuation of his style. But I don't think it looks as much of a Porsche as the Avalanche.
I think I agree with you on that. Yeah. I mean, look at the side profile of that. It does look fake almost.
Yeah. It almost, and not that it's good or bad, but it almost looks like what was coming out of some Japanese companies at the time.
So. Interesting.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Depending on the order, the Cirrus was based on the late 930 and later the early 964 gens of the 911 Carrera Cabriolet. The entirely redone interior boasted either full leather or Alcantara upholstery.
I was going to say it almost looks a little Volkswagen-y too. Like there's a lot going on there.
Along with eye-catching details on the dashboards and seats. For drivers who needed a bit of entertainment, the Cirrus featured car phones, VCRs, and state-of-the-art surround sound systems. New digital clusters and futuristic center console switches made the cockpit of the Cirrus feel more like the Millennium Falcon than a road car.
My the Taurus, the cop car's got, like, it's all bare bones, right? Mm-hmm. But in the back, so you've got the spares in this kind of this foam thing, and then there's just a big old sheet of hard plastic, but on the side it curves up, and there's like two little compartments. Sometimes I'll put stuff in it and I feel like Han Solo.
Smuggling. Nice.
Yep, exactly.
The exterior of the Cirrus featured several gorgeous design tweaks, including integrated side strakes that were reminiscent of the doors of the Ferrari Testarossa, which I mentioned. Take a closer look at the doors and you'll notice there's no visible door handle. It's actually a hidden button under the top lip of the strake. So there you go. Little boop. Everyone does that now. Everyone's got the stupid hidden button door handle. But they were probably one of the first. Some of the first. I bet there's like lowrider guys doing this, though.
Lowriders have been doing like a lot of crazy shit forever.
The convertible option made the Cirrus particularly exotic, with its wide stance extended by custom fenders and front and rear bumpers. The body was more aerodynamic and smooth than traditional 911 models. And like the Avalanche, the Cirrus came complete with extravagant paint jobs. The Cirrus's engine wasn't as powerful as that of the Avalanche, but it was no slouch either. With a naturally aspirated 3.2-liter roof-tuned flat six that had 228 horsepower, and a top speed of 160 miles an hour, the Cirrus could still hang with many of its peers. Debuting smack dab in the middle of the cocaine 80s, they fit perfectly alongside the most outrageous designs coming out of Europe at the time, like the Lamborghini Countach and Ferrari Testarossa. Very few Cirruses were produced. Rumor has it less than 15, which has led, naturally, to their cult-like following among today's Porsche enthusiasts. I think the Avalanche is cooler, though.
I think it is, too.
The attention the Avalanche and Cirrus achieved for Gambala put them in the direct focus of some major luxury car manufacturers. By 1988, Uwe was routinely summoned to create upgrade packages for Rolls-Royce, Ferrari, and Mercedes, all while maintaining an intimate tie with Porsche. Gambala solidified itself as a symbol of excess and opulence in the 1980s, while also reinventing the rules of aftermarket automotive design. As the decade came to a close, a new generation of customers were coming of age, and with it came a new era for Gambala. So here we go. We're going into the 1990s.
Let's do it.
I watched Hocus Pocus this weekend, which came out in 1993, the year I was born, and I was like, all these kids in this movie, they're kids. And then I was like, oh, no, they're all not much older, but, you know, older than me. Strange feeling. The 1990s marked the transition from the gauche excess of the 80s to a more mature idea of what a luxury car should look like. There were certainly futuristic models in the 90s, such as the advent of the supercar era, ushered in by the McLaren F1, Bugatti EB110, and Lamborghini Diablo. But Gambala took a more grounded path while still pushing the boundaries of power and singular style. In the early 90s, Gambala produced aerodynamic and technology packages for the Porsche 964 and 993, which was the first production model Porsche to feature all-wheel drive and a twin-turbo engine depending on the trim. These innovations from Porsche helped Gambala produce even more heart-stopping models like the Extremo Biturbo. Oh, mama. That's interesting looking.
I like it.
You like it?
It's round. You know what I mean? Like, they're rounding things off. Look at the hood
convertible
scoop.
One is sick as hell, though. That's cool.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. If I saw it in person, I'd probably think that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But that's a swing. That's a swing. Yeah. I'll say that, dear listener. This 993 derived supercar featured a 500 horsepower, house-tuned, flat six turbo. They produced it as a promotional vehicle for luxury tire maker Fulda.
And it's all-wheel drive.
In 1997. That's right. At one stop of Fulda's tour of the $1.2 million Extremo, Sheikh Abdul Mohsen tried to purchase the vehicle, but the company declined. Sheikh Abdul Mohsen wanted the car so badly that he hired Gambala to make him one of his own. Gambala bumped this second Extremo to over 600 horsepower, nearly 200 horsepower more than the stock 993 turbo.
What's funny about that is it's like, yeah, that's how this works. Yeah. You hire the person who makes the car to make you the car.
Yeah, that was kind of the whole point of them building that first one.
Yeah.
And they finished the car in sunshine yellow. But as time went on, the Sheikh clearly lost interest because the car was found and abandoned, covered in dust and debris outside a residence in Dubai in January of this year. When he wasn't...
It is crazy in Dubai how many exotic million-plus dollar cars you'll see just gathering dust.
We did a video about it a few years ago, and a big part of that is that a lot of...
They don't have any oil.
No, yeah, they just run out. They can't do the oil changes anymore. No, there's a lot of either expats or people who work in the country in Dubai. They make a ton of money. They'll buy a cool car and then lose their job or something happens. They'll leave the country and then they'll just abandon the car.
Yeah.
And that's how that happens. When he wasn't making one-of-a-kind supercars for Middle East royals, Gambala spent the later part of the 90s learning guitar. Creating specialized technology and aerodynamic packages for the Porsche 996, as well as upgrades for the newly introduced Boxster. Despite the Boxster being on the lower end of the Porsche totem pole, Gambala created some truly gorgeous versions of this modest entry-level car, particularly in the early 2000s with twin-turbo engines in the Boxster S, which sounds absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. The 90s may have been Gambala's peak era, but in the face of new competition from aftermarket tuners like Roof and TechArt, as well as various global economic swings, they still maintained a distinct vision entering the new millennium.
Can you pull up a version of...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, brother. Dude, that's sick.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
That is really cool. Oh. And the nose works.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So there's a lot...
It's like a mini, Carrera GT. That's cool.
Yeah,
that's really sick. Oh, I love that.
Good for them, dude. Good for them. Bless their heart.
Rolled up in
bless
that,
their heart.
Yeah, if someone rolled up in that to I don't know, whatever.
There's
event.
There's elements of Bugatti in it. There's so much going on that somehow works. That feels good.
I love that. In the early 2000s, Porsche introduced a number of exciting new models. New versions of the 911 and a surge of interest in luxury SUVs gave Gambala exciting opportunities to create completely new works of art. In 2001, Gambala unveiled the new GTR 600, which was based on the 996 Turbo. One of the most innovative tweaks on the GTR 600 was its butterfly hinge doors. The next year, Gambala debuted the 996 GT3-based 600R, which set a street-legal vehicle lap record at the Nürburgring Nordschleife with a blistering time of 7 minutes 32 and a half seconds, nearly 30 seconds faster than a stock Carrera. The GTR 600 also went on to claim a GT class trophy at the Hockenheim Ring. Nice.
I wonder what happens internally at a company like Porsche when this happens. If they're like, good for them, or they're like, guys.
Yeah.
If
I was a project manager, I'd be like, yeah. We can't let these little guys upstage us. We're the big dog.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
Following Porsche's launch of their first ever SUV, the Cayenne, Gambala premiered the Aero 3 package in 2003. The modified twin-turbo engine made a whopping 750 horses, good lord, which is more power than a 2025 Porsche Cayenne e-hybrid turbo, by the way. Gambala also spared no expense in the interior, which featured integrated multimedia headrests, meaning TVs in the back of the headrest, and custom leather rear sport seats. Nice. 2005 brought about one of the fastest Gambala cars ever, the GTR 650 Avalanche. This new version of the iconic Avalanche was a 997 Carrera S-based beast that had 650 horses and can go 210 miles an hour. Good lord. And while the new-look Avalanche GTRs and Aero 3s were certainly beautiful machines, no Gambala creation of the 2000s made more of a statement than the Gambala Mirage GT. Introduced in 2005, the Mirage GT took everything the stock Carrera GT offered and pushed it to the ultimate performance and visual limit. In terms of power, Gambala kept the Carrera's 5.7-liter V10 engine, but added an advanced exhaust that resulted in over 670 horsepower. They also made carbon air intake tweaks and reworked the engine mapping, giving the Mirage a 3.6-second 0-60 time. With custom carbon fiber bumpers, side skirts, and a hood, along with deeper air ducts and a fixed rear wing, the Mirage was noticeably more extravagant than the modest Carrera GT base. And like Gambala's marvels from years before, the Mirage GT featured premium audio and video systems, futuristic instrument clusters, with stunning bespoke leather upholstery. Only 25 Mirage GTs were made, and each cost well over $1 million, about $1.6 million in 2025.
Can you pull it up for me?
Yeah. Today, it's seen as one of the greatest tuner supercars in history. The Mirage GT was the epitome of Gambala's creative greatness. It set the stage for what should have been an exciting new chapter for the company, but no one could have anticipated what came next. But before we get to that, Bart, I'll show you the Gambala Mirage. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Not as crazy as I thought it was going to look, but there she is. The Mirage.
It does look very Porsche.
Yeah.
But again, this is out of, from what you were saying, I was expecting it to be a bit more out there. I think it looks great. It looks like a Porsche.
It's
subtle tweaks. It's not like the Avalanche. You
it's
know?
Subtle by Gambala standards,
yes.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, I was expecting. There's another Gambala. I don't know if it's Carrera GT based, but you know what? I'm thinking of they did make eventually a bespoke car that was completely of their own design, and that's what I was thinking this was going to look like. But no, this is a Mirage. It's a Carrera GT with a body kit, and also better everything, faster everything. Very cool, man. That's cool. I love it. Gambala doesn't really come up in conversation a lot.
No. Well, they didn't.
For whatever reason,
they weren't. I don't think they're as prolific. You know what I mean? Is part of why. Looking at all of their cars, you can tell it's like they're not for everybody.
No, they're not. Definitely not. Yeah. It's like almost one or two kind of like notches close to like a Mansory or something like that.
Right.
It appeals to like the Mansory crowd, maybe. Which, if you don't know, Mansory very. Controversial like body kit manufacturer. They quote unquote ruin a lot of cars, but you know, their clientele is just very rich people, and I think Gambala is the same way. A lot of wealthy people buying these cars, definitely not purists, quote unquote, buying these. I think
this is another interesting though of note, I think, is that we're telling the story because there's so little that is known about what's going on within and around this company, I think intentionally, like the story of the company is being told by their product, which is cool. It's been written that man writes his history in three books, the book of words, the book of deeds, and the book of art.
Wow.
And out of all of these, the book of art is probably the most true. But anyways, we're getting this man's story through the art of the car, so.
The global financial crisis of 2009 rocked the luxury auto market, and Uwe found himself anxiously looking for new investors. It's no secret that Uwe operated in an industry where big egos and even bigger sums of money often came as a package deal. Gambala's ability to personally work for some of the wealthiest people on Earth was a boon for business, but it also came with the risk of potentially offending one of his investors or clients and facing some backlash. In February of 2010, 55-year-old Uwe went to South Africa to meet with a potential investor named Jerome Sapphire. However, shortly after touching down at OR Tambo Airport and getting into a Volkswagen Golf, Uwe disappeared. After 3 days of anxiety and dread, Uwe's wife, Christiane, back in Germany, received a call from a mysterious man who demanded a ransom of 1 million euros for Gambala's release. Uwe was put on the phone and spoke with Christiane, and they said they would call back an instructor where to deposit the money. Unfortunately, though, that call would never come. In fact, it would take 8 months before Uwe's body was finally discovered in a black plastic bag in a shallow grave near Atteridgeville, South Africa. Investigators charged multiple men in connection with Uwe's murder and kidnapping, including Jerome Safi, who was the man behind the Jerome Sapphire alias. Safi and his accomplices admitted to killing
Uwe. So this is a guy who didn't exist, who lured him to South Africa under an alias.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Safi and his accomplices admitted to killing Uwe under the order of a high-level Czechoslovakian criminal named Radovan Krejcir, who had allegedly made a deal with Gambala to smuggle cash inside Gambala cars bound for South Africa. According to Juan Meyer, one of the other men arrested with Safi, Gambala shipped a Porsche Cayenne to South Africa shortly before his doomed trip. The Cayenne was supposed to have 1 million euros hidden inside, but when it arrived, the money was nowhere to be found, and Krejcir was furious. Again, this is a criminal suspect telling the story, so take it with a big grain of salt. But if it were true, it would seem logical for Uwe to want to patch things up in person. But when he arrived in South Africa, he found that Krejcir was in no mood to bargain. Despite the finger-pointing, Krejcir had placed himself far enough away from Uwe's kidnapping that he escaped formal charges. However, only a few years later, he was sentenced to 35 years in a South African prison for the attempted murder and kidnapping of a different man. The events surrounding Uwe Gambala's death are nearly as enigmatic as the man's life itself. Despite being the name behind one of the most exclusive, well-connected luxury brands in the world, Uwe was relentlessly avoidant of the press. To this day, much of his personal life remains a mystery. It's nearly impossible to find information about his parents, how he got the money to start his company, or how he managed to fly under the radar for so many years. Despite the lingering questions, there was one certainty. After their leader's passing, Gambala was on the brink of collapse. Dude, that's tragic.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It was not a great time for the economy. I could see him needing to find other avenues of revenue and just making a bad decision like that. Getting in bed with some bad people.
Certainly plausible.
Yeah. Dang, dude. That sucks. Wow. Shortly after Uwe Gambala's death, the company declared bankruptcy and production was halted. Fortunately, German businessman Stefan Korbach stepped in with his partner Andreas Schwartz and bought the remaining assets. Relaunched as Gambala GmbH in 2011, the new executives immediately set out to restore the company's reputation. Schwartz, an automotive engineer himself, wasted no time by debuting two all-new Gambala models in 2011, the Tornado and the Mistrale, both of which featured lightweight carbon fiber paneling. Quote, "Modern cars are larger and heavier despite high-tech materials," said Schwartz in an interview with Motor Trend. "A power increase is good, but the ultimate solution is more power and less weight. My concept for our Panamera-based Mistrale and Cayenne-based Tornado was to replace most of the body panels with carbon fiber parts, incorporating wider arches and functional styling motifs." In 2012, Korbach announced that Gambala GmbH was officially partnering with McLaren to help develop a package for the McLaren MP4-12C and 12C Spider. Remember those things? While Gambala didn't touch the McLaren 600-horsepower V8 twin-turbo engine, they made up for it with distinctive body additions like side skirts and a rear wing, along with aggressive 20-inch and 21-inch wheels. Neat.
May I see it?
Yeah, sure. It's an understated design, I think. It's all right.
And it does. It looks a little McLaren. Looks a little Porsche. Looks.
Yeah, I think it's certainly, you know, I think
it doesn't have the character.
It doesn't have
Uwe's
that Uwe touch, man. Yeah.
You know what it looks like? A Grand Theft Auto car.
Yeah, it does.
You know, where it's like, that's a car.
Yeah. The mid-2010s saw Gambala release a fresh iteration of the Cayenne-inspired Aero package, as well as a 918 Spider-based new-gen Mirage. In 2019, Gambala released the 991-based GTR 8XX Evo R bi-turbo. Is that enough superlatives for you? With a modified 3.8-liter engine capable of 818 horsepower and a top speed of over 230 miles per hour. Good Lord. An aerodynamic marvel, the GTR 8XX featured a
Biturbo
Evo R. Featured carbon fiber bodywork that enhanced speed through function and extraordinary lightweight materials, apparently according to Gambala. Let's look this thing up. Again, it's playing it a little safe, methinks.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a Porsche with a funky wing. right?
Yeah. I mean, I like the hood.
It's not to say it's not a remarkable.
No, it's really cool looking.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't have that stank, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't have the stank on it. So, with the help of Korbach and Schwartz, Gambala had successfully avoided disaster in the 2010s and was able to maintain their reputation as a premier aftermarket tuner. However, as the decade came to a close, word began to spread that a new Gambala company was about to begin.
Ooh.
As Korbach and Schwartz continued to steer Gambala GmbH into the 2020s, Uwe's son, Marc Philippe, started his own tuning company. Marc Philippe Gambala GmbH launched in 2020, with Marc's goal to maintain his family's legacy of singular automotive aftermarket design. However, Marc said that his objectives differed slightly from his father's. Quote, "I don't feel the need, the desire to do what my father did, to set the top speed records, to challenge the world in that way. This is different. It's the future. Something new. Yes, it is by a Gambala. I am a Gambala, but not the way it was." The debut vehicle from Marc Gambala was the Massien, an aggressive 800-horsepower machine built off a 992 Turbo S 911. Inspired by the 959 Paris-Dakar, the model leaned into the Porsche Safari ethos, which focused on being functional and durable while still seething with modern luxury. Oh, I'm seething right now. Seething with modern luxury. To emphasize the off-road capabilities of the Massien, Gambala reinforced the chassis, and thanks to state-of-the-art suspension and technology, it can quickly transform from a stunning road car to an off-road brawler. Limited to just 40 units, the Massien is one of the most exclusive modern vehicles in the world and has made it clear that the Gambala name is safe in Marc Philippe's hands. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty neat. With a new era of EVs and hypercars on the horizon, the two Gambala companies are primed for an exciting, albeit slightly different future. Korbach and Schwartz have made it clear that the future of Gambala GmbH lies in elite hypercars that prioritize singular performance, while Marc Philippe is focused on a more practical supercar that can go anywhere. So, what started as a small aftermarket specialist in 1979 quickly turned into an icon, with cars like the Avalanche, Cirrus, and Mirage being some of the most rare and sought-after cars in the world today. Uwe Gambala modified cars in a way no one was at the time, and in doing so, created a niche market for supercars that companies like Brabus and Mansory, and one could argue Rocket Bunny and Liberty Walks as well. Gambala's connection with Porsche will always be at the forefront of its legacy, but their work for other luxury brands like McLaren continues to spread their influence. Today, Uwe Gambala's son, Marc Philippe, carries on his father's ethos of merging exotic engineering with radical design and personal luxury, and you know what? I wish him well.
Yeah.
I wish him well. Man, I mean, looking at these older Gambala, like the 80s and 90s cars, they're unique, you know?
Yeah.
Like, truly. That Avalanche, dude, that thing is so crazy, but so cool. I don't know if anyone else will be able to kind of replicate his take on cars,
yeah.
You know? It's a real tragedy that he went out the way he did, man. That's really unfortunate. Wow. Again, I think really underrated. Mm-hmm. Company. I think these cars are kind of not represented in the conversation as often as they should be, and I would love to see one.
Even
of these.
Even we focused a lot on looks, but even just the numbers are, when you take them when they were coming out and what they were doing
ahead of their time,
really, really nuts.
Really,
they're
cool.
Not in the conversation more.
Yeah, that was the story of Gambala. You know, sad story, but an evolving one. And we'll see what Gambala GmbH and what Marc Philippe can do in the future. And I wish Marc Philippe a lot of luck here, and I'm, you know, the best. Man, that's tough. But I think that Dakar thing is really sick, too. So, all right, that's been the show. Thank you guys so much for listening. My name is Nolan. You can follow me at Nolan J. Sykes on Instagram or Blue Sky, if you want. And then Bart. Bids Bardo on Instagram. Hit him up.
All right. See you there.
I'm looking forward to the new crime podcast. And thank you to our crew behind the camera and our writer this week, Luke Klompine, doing a great job as always. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.